Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm very pleased to have with me today in the studio on Talking Books, Philip Leone Canado. One of the most pleasant aspects of my work is that I do sometimes have the opportunity to meet up with students, especially when they are of the organizing type, those who, that are interested in putting events together. People talk about students' apathy, but my guest today is certainly someone who breaks that mold. Law student, Philip has started to make a name for himself, however, as an actor and as a theatre director, with several successes under his belt. He's performed as an actor in Art, a play by Yasmina Reza, which was put up at the MITP Theatre in Valletta. In Shakespeare Revisited, this year with MADC, he performed as Henry V and as Bassanio. He was Orestes in Electra, played by Sophocles, which was held in Greece, a multilingual production in Italian, English and Greek. He has directed All in the Timing by David Ive, very successfully here at on campus at the university, Seven Jewish Children by Carol Churchill, with his group What's Their Names? And this group has recently participated in Evenings on Campus with a 2 one-act plays by Woody Allen, which I might say were very well received by audiences and also by the critics. Welcome to Talking Books, Philip.
Thank you.
Well, before we start to talk about your chosen text, I have to ask you the question that I ask all my guests. What are your first memories of the written word? How did your relationship with the written word start off?
Yeah, well, my parents were always very insistent on reading. They held out on getting cable for a long time to make sure we tried to read as much as possible. So I remember probably the first books I remember actually reading were informative books on sharks and dinosaurs, which are my obsession as a young boy. I loved them. So I had these two books that I would just carry around with me everywhere and tell everyone who wanted to listen, and probably a bunch of people who didn't, all about things I'd learnt in these books. Then from there I remember reading a lot of these magazines that used to come out, like A Tree of Knowledge and Find It Out, and these magazines that you'd collect, and I remember, again, just reading those cover to cover and carefully storing all the pages. I think I actually moved on to sort of novel reading a bit later on, and really then became obsessed with novels. I read The Lord of the Rings when I was pretty young and just fell in love with that, and then read it again and again and again. Like every child of my generation, I read Enid Blyton and The Famous Five and Mystery Solvers and all those books.
And then the tastes were sort of wide.
And unfortunately, it never went away, so I'm still reading. I'm never without a book. So, and I try to, again, keep as broad as possible. I don't like to sort of limit my reading to one genre or one author.
You're an omnivore.
Yes, pretty much. So you have to digest some utter rubbish, but sometimes you find a real gem.
Well, the omnivore in you probably has taken you not only to novels and that sort of book, but also to plays.
Yes, I read a lot of plays these days. Obviously, because of my work with What's Their Names, I'm always on the lookout for new material and this and that and the other. And even when I'm working as an actor with different companies, I'm always being given scripts to read. So it's there's a lot of play reading, which is different because obviously a play is much shorter in print. So you can get through a play in a few hours. You get a very different feeling because a novel is meant to be read, whereas a play is meant to be performed. So it's a different experience reading it, but it's very interesting just reading plays and seeing them in your head being performed. It's fascinating.
I'm always interested when I read scripts. When you get the conversation, but the bits in between, which would give the director like yourself the instructions, really, yes. The instruction book. This is happening at that moment. I find that that fascinating, I must yes. say.
And of course, there's a lot, and that's exactly it, there's a lot in the script that isn't there. Apart from the stage directions like Sally moves left, there's a lot that's unwritten. In someone like Pinter, for example, it's made obvious a silence in Pinter can mean everything. The simple stage direction, silence, can imply. Tom Stoppard is another author who loves to give rather vague stage directions. In one play that I've just read of his, The Real Inspector Hound, one of his stage directions is that a character looks at another and the stage direction is written of such small victories and defeats. And that must mean something to a director, and then that's the director's job to create on stage. So it is a very interesting task. And obviously the language is still there on page for everyone to read.
Yes, I think that I don't know anything really about theatre, but I think it must be a lovely game to play for a director, that game between looking at what the original writer of the play, the script writer, wanted or has written on paper, and actually then doing your own yes. interpretation of it.
Obviously, I'm obviously very inexperienced when it comes to these things, but with the little experience I've got, I do see this coming out, and especially I have a deep love obviously for Shakespeare, and there you see it more than ever, because Shakespeare is now 400 years old and each one of his plays has been performed many, many times. So you're torn between trying to create something new, which may not even be possible given the huge wealth you've got behind you. So it's taking the text as a starting point. The text is never sacred in something like this. You need to explore, you need to discover, but then obviously remaining faithful to what the author intended and aiming to create something that is really fresh and is really your own. So there's an interesting balance there, which is for the director and also for the actors involved is huge fun to explore.
The book you've chosen to discuss is Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. And I must confess that I did not know this book before you mentioned it. And unfortunately, we didn't have that much time between your declaring that you wanted to speak about it and this interview. So I haven't had a chance to read it from cover to cover. But obviously, with today's modern technology, I was able to have a pretty good look at it. I was interested to see that, well, I suppose it reflects your love of the visual, because unlike many TV series and films that start off life as a book and then become TV series or films, this started off life in the visual and then ended up in the written. But I gather that when you picked up the book originally, you were actually not aware of that fact.
Yes, actually, this is one of those books that I came across completely by accident. I was going abroad, I was in the airport, and I desperately needed a book for the plane. It was a long flight, and I had nothing to read. So I just quickly dashed into the airport bookshop and picked up the first book I could find with an interesting cover, and that was Neverwhere.
Always a good way of judging.
Yes. It's called random book selection. You come up with a few good ones, and this was one of them. So I didn't know it was a TV series. Excuse me. I didn't know it was a TV series when I was reading it. When I was reading up about it afterwards, which is something I do, I found out about the TV series, and I thought that was interesting, because often I'm one of those people who finds it hard to appreciate a TV series or a film based on a book. I'm always one of those people saying, oh, well, the book was better. But this worked the other way. Neil Gaiman first worked on the TV series, and then, getting annoyed at how much he was forced to cut for the TV series, decided to write a full book. And, well, I'm glad he did.
I managed to find a couple of interviews with Neil Gaiman on YouTube, as everyone does, yeah. And I must say that he comes across as one of those very bright, very creative, quite cool yeah. people, really.
Well, I mean, if you look at the books he's written so far, he's a if one had to, you know, pigeonhole him, it would be he is a fantasy writer. Just to think of some of the books off the top of my head, he's written Stardust, which takes place in a mythical land, and it's about a boy trying to find a fallen star. He's written American Gods, which takes as its premise that the Greek gods, the gods of Olympus, are still alive in suburban USA. And it involves, you know, the main character traveling across the USA and basically interacting with these gods. Neverwhere itself is set in a magical land below London. So it's all very fantastical, but what I think sets him apart from the the many fantasy writers we have today is that he's more eccentric. He's willing to explore in a way that most people aren't. There are no elves or dwarves in his books, but he brings fantasy home. It's what if fantasy were happening right now? What if we are living fantasy? Would we know it? How would we interact with that? How would that shape our lives? And that's interesting because to me that's what fantasy is all about. It's not the supernatural, but what's happening between the cracks of the natural.
In fact, at this point, I think for the benefit of our listeners who might not have seen either the TV series or read the book, that's a little potted description of what's the book about.
No, as I said, I had no idea about the book before I read it, so all my impressions were completely fresh. It's the basic plot of the story involves Richard Mayhew, who is a young 30-something businessman, very successful in his company, has an attractive girlfriend, they're both doing very well, and one day on his way to a dinner with his girlfriend's boss, he sees a homeless person lying on the ground, possibly injured. His girlfriend wants to keep moving, they're late for their dinner, and he decides that that can't be helped, and he actually carries this person home to his house. Now that sounds like the start of your typical Good Samaritan, coffee table book, but it goes in a completely different direction, when it turns out that he, by doing this, which is something most people, myself included, would never do, he's allowed himself to see a world that doesn't exist to most of us, which is London below. He lives in London above, which is the London that we know. And there also exists London below, which is described in the book itself as a place for the people who have fallen between the cracks. The people who are no longer a part of the world outside. Which, in practical terms, means homeless people. It means people like Richard who have dared to cross this invisible boundary. And he finds himself quickly drawn into he's your usual reluctant hero. He's drawn into a vast conspiracy and a vast adventure that he doesn't really want to be a part in. What really makes the book is the characters, the crazy characters that he encounters. And London below as a world is fleshed out in a way that's extremely interesting to us. The names that we encounter in London below reflect London above. So for example, Harrods, which we know is in Knightsbridge, is in London below across the Bridge of Night, Knightsbridge. The Blackfriars station is the home of the Blackfriars, a mythical order of monks that guard a sacred key. So you've got all these fantasy clichés, including Earl's Court being the court of an actual Earl who travels the trains in blocked-off carriages and hosts his guests with Coca-Cola and M&Ms from the vending machine. You've got these eccentric characters who all populate a world that we know, but not quite. And I think it's so appealing because it's something probably most people have wondered about names like Elephant and Castle and the Angel Islington, and what if there was an actual reason, what if there was an actual Earl or an actual Baron, and what if we could somehow approach this?
Could be for children, and I think the TV series is more or less a children's program. But of course, it isn't, because in a way the characters are quite frightening. But I suppose they are in the league of the frightening characters in Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. So frightening characters for children have been around a long time.
Obviously, there are some very frightening characters. The two characters that we're introduced to very early in the novel and who carry us through the whole thing are Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer. We never hear their first names. The implication throughout the novel is that they travel through space and time in an alternate prologue to the book, which eventually got cut but is presented in the at the end of the text. We see them burning down a 16th century monastery. And then they travel to 21st century London, which is where the story takes place. They're killers. They're murderers.
They're evil.
And what makes them so frightening is exactly that they take, they're childlike. They're not evil. They don't walk around in dark suits. They are two very big, very scary men. In one scene, they crush a person's skull. Mr. Vandermeer crushes a man's skull in his fist. So they are very scary characters who are like children. They enjoy killing. In one scene, they get annoyed at their employer because he's told them to escort someone, and they say, that's not what we do. In another scene, Mr. Krupp is disabled because someone holds a piece of Ming Dynasty vase over a hole in the ground and threatens to drop it, and Mr. Krupp has a deep love for Ming Dynasty vases, so he can't allow that to happen. But then when he finally gets hold of it in the negotiation, he calmly places it on the table, smashes it, and sort of just smells the dust. So it's this sort of weird characters, very frightening, but I think they are within the realm of your standard. They are they're the antagonists, the antagonist's henchmen rather, and they carry you through the whole novel. At times you're frightened of them, but most of the time they're great fun to be around.
What about the Marquis de Carabas?
Marquis de Carabas. In an interview Neil Gaiman gave about the book, they asked him about the possibility of a sequel. He said, I don't do sequels, but if I had to do one, it would center around a recent news story he heard where a team of workers in the London sewers came across a large brass bed, and nobody had any idea how it got there. And he said, I'm fascinated by that bed, and I wish I knew how it got there. Unfortunately, nobody does. And as the interview was about to carry on, he slipped in, well, I expect the Marquis de Carabas does. The Marquis is, again, we never learn another name. It's just the Marquis de Carabas. He deals in favors. He never deals in money. He deals in favors. And characters we encounter, he serves as a guide of sorts through the book, because he knows everything there is to know about London below. He's not a friendly guide. He's constantly berating Richard, constantly berating us. And the characters we encounter through him, nobody seems to like him. Everyone's scared of him and his favors. At one point in the book, he allows himself to be killed because, by his own admission, people tend to say rather a lot when they know you're about to be dead, and even more when they think you are dead. So he's a very colorful character. From his first introduction, he comes in brightly, being heralded by a few rats. And again, he's just one of those characters that really draws us into this strange world of London below.
What about Dore?
Dore is our female protagonist. As one would expect from a couple of pages in, she's eventually Richard's love interest. The adventure of London below is her story. Her entire family was killed by a group of people assumed to be Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer, and she's trying to find out why, trying to get away herself. The book opens with her running away. Dore is a group, is one of her family are the only openers. They can open doors where no doors exist. And obviously in the context of the book, this has its huge importance in the plot. She uses this skill in very practical ways, and also in the climax of the book it serves a great role. But obviously in the broader spectrum it explains a lot about the book's structure. Dore is one of those people who can open doors between places, between thoughts, between ideas, between, crucially, the world we know and the world of people who have fallen between the cracks. Dore is the woman who Richard Mayhew saves at the beginning of the book. Again, she's fallen out of a door she's created into our world. And by the end of the book, when Richard decides to return to London below, after he spends the whole book trying to get back to his world, he decides to return to London below, and it's through her and for her. So she serves an important role both sort of in the story and out of the story. And also as a character, she's a very, very interesting, person to be around for Richard and for everyone else. Again, she's got this childlike innocence. When she asks Richard his name, he says, he's confused by what's going on, and he says, Richard, Richard Mayhew, Dick. And she says, oh, hello, Richard, Richard Mayhew, Dick. So she carries us on with everything else, and it's obviously her story, so...
Because the book does have humour in it. Sometimes it's black, but sometimes it's just humour. So that also carries one through, I think.
In fact, in an interview he had given, he had discussed the problems of marketing the book to an American audience, which obviously, you know, we've heard in recent times with the Harry Potter books where words had to be translated into American English. Here he said the problem was that American audiences are less likely, apparently, to accept jokes and accept humour in a book that isn't a comedy. Neverwhere isn't a comedy. It's it is a fantasy book. Urban fantasy would probably be the label one would apply. It obviously has a strong allegory in it to our modern situation, but it's not a comedy. It's very funny throughout. Obviously the whole idea of London Below is incredibly tongue-in-cheek. The idea that Angel Islington is so named because it's the hometown, it's a home area of an angel named Islington is funny in itself. It's not something we'd expect. The Blackfriars, all these, and the characters I've been discussing, they're all weird characters that are funny in themselves. Old Bailey enjoys selling pigeons and information. And so there are jokes, there are some very black humour, of course, from Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar killing monks and laughing about it, to the basic premise of the story, which opens with Dawes' entire family being killed. There are some very black moments. Some are used for humour. There's a moment where Dawes is, no way to sugarcoat it, almost raped by the Earl of Earl's Court. And it's very black humour. Then there are some much lighter moments, like the joke I mentioned with Richard's name and Richard's general reluctance to be involved. So it's a sort of book that I think isn't afraid to have a laugh at itself, at the world, but at the same time keeping its base in what it wants to say.
It does use this idea of parallel worlds, which seems to be a theme that attracts people very much. I mean, clearly Alice in Wonderland comes to mind immediately. I'm a particular fan of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, where again you have a knife being used to cut open doors into another world. This sort of the Cartesian paradox idea, where everyone asks oneself the question, what is reality? Mm-hmm. If everything is possible, then what are we doing? Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a theme that is very attractive.
I think the attraction, at least for me, because I've read His Dark Materials, I've read Neverwhere, obviously Alice in Wonderland, there are a lot of books that deal with this notion of what if. And I think what attracts us is this sense always that we are missing something, that not inside us, but that we're failing to see something. And Alice in Wonderland is that. Alice, I suppose what kickstarts the novel is her being stifled, that sense of the proper Victorian culture. And then the novel just takes us to the diametric opposite of that. In Philip Pullman, it's, in a lot of senses, the parallel worlds literalize elements of our world. Obviously, the entire novel can be described, the entire trilogy can be described as a playing out of Paradise Lost in very literal terms. God, ultimately, in that novel, is discovered, again, in the most literal way possible. He's an old man in a box. In this novel, I think what has inspired him, and
well, I can't presume to say what inspired him, but what I think is part of the backing of the novel is something that possibly, as a Maltese person, I've seen a lot. When I travel to other cities, and I see to large cities, and you see homeless people and people living outside, it's stranger, I feel, to me than to a local, because I'm not used to it. Because in Malta, it's not a sight we see often. In Malta, for some reason, there aren't these people who have fallen between the cracks. If there are, they live in a very different way to in London or thing, or London or Paris or New York. But in these cities, there are these people who are part of civilization. They are living in one of the biggest cities in the world, yet they're not part of it. They inhabit a world that is completely different from basic facts of living outside to other people, things even like sleeping during the day, which has to be done, seems strange. And that is exactly what the novel looks at. It's, what if there was a world that explains this? That explains this. Some might call it escapism. Some might call it, well, yeah, we're scared of dealing with it as a social reality. So what if there was a world where it made sense? But I think in London below, rather than escaping, as Tolkien once had put it, it's willing succession instead of escaping. It's willingly saying, let us look at this place where it makes sense, and perhaps by that, make sense of our own world. Richard fails in his first attempt to get into London below. He fails completely. He can't understand. He backs off in horror as they talk to rats. He backs off in horror as they explore these strange places. On Knightsbridge, when a woman next to him just disappears and everyone keeps going, he can't understand what's happened and why they're all carrying on as if nothing's gone wrong. Because he's the stranger here. He's the person who's fallen between the cracks. And obviously the bits where he is there, when he's still trying to get to terms with what has happened to him and he's trying to live his normal life and everyone in London above is ignoring him, pretending he's not there, his house is rented out while he's still living in it. It's pretty poignant because that's really how it is. Homeless people might as well not be there at all for all the attention.
Total exclusion. Others give them
total exclusion. And I think that's exactly what the draw of this other London is, this sense that perhaps there's another London where we are the outsiders, where we are ignored. And
yes, I found it a fascinating theme, and obviously Neil Gaiman, his style of writing includes, he's obviously a bright guy, he has lots of literary allusions, which it doesn't really matter whether you catch them or you don't,
yeah.
But certainly it's interesting and satisfying, I would imagine, at various levels. Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you very, very much, Philip Leona Ganado.
Thank you.
For coming to talk to us on Talking Books today. Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.